Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch brings you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's WWE Monday Night Raw.
All right, Jake, we still have Seth Rollins as U.S. champion, but we have, I guess, two other feuds sprouting off from that match with Mustafa Ali chasing Seth out of the building practically at the end, and then Elias in the mix. I wasn't sure during the segment with Matt Riddle if they were setting up a feud or an alliance between them. What was your take on that closing segment and the dynamic with those key players?
Well, I'm curious if we may get like a fatal four-way situation play out at Crown Jewel.
Yeah.
Just because it, like you said, it wasn't entirely clear which direction they were going with Riddle and Elias. If Elias was just going to be, you know, continually annoyed by Riddle to the point where he just kind of snaps and goes after him. And they didn't lean too hard in one direction or another with the way the match played out. But, I wouldn't be surprised if we see all four of them in and out of the U.S. title picture here for the next little while, at least until they can get through Survivor Series.
I like the little nod by Elias to his younger brother. It was just a quick writing off of the Ezekiel character, but at least acknowledging it.
Yeah, I didn't expect them to even address it, honestly, and so I was pleasantly surprised to, you know, to see them, you know, just quickly broom Ezekiel out of the way, and Riddle also sort of acknowledged his existence as well about how we used to get all zeked up or whatever the catchphrase was. It was fine for what it was.
It's amazing after how much the Zeke merch sold that they decided to abandon that version of Elias' family member wrestling character.
Yeah, surprisingly, he was only gone as long as it takes him to grow a full beard, and then he just came.
I was thinking the same thing. I actually get the sense Elias can grow that beard like in about 4 days. He just seems like that kind of guy.
And clean shaven, just, I don't know, it never quite suited him for me, but maybe it was just because I got adjusted to him with wearing a full beard first.
No, I think there are some people who just are meant to have a beard, and some people who either can't or aren't. And in his case, I think he just, once he shaved, it's like, yeah, you're a beard guy. So
I can never get past the vaguely untrustworthy hobo phase in beard growth. So I've never had the chance to wear one, but they do look very good on other people.
Yeah. So I mean, do you have any problem with the way things played out in the U.S. title match? Was it too cute by half or anything like that, or was it kind of just clever storytelling and entertaining WWE style storytelling, setting up some things?
Yeah, I mean, I wish they would find a way to give us, clean finishes for some of these matches without having all the unnecessary interference. But I understand, they're trying to add two people into the mix and also, you know, keep going what's happening between Riddle and Seth Rollins. And so, sometimes they sort of paint themselves into a corner. But I did think they did a decent job of, you know, not only reintroducing Elias, but raising the stock of Mustafa Ali throughout the show so that his, you know, participation in the final segment made sense and he didn't seem completely out of place or random when he showed up.
Yeah, I felt like Riddle had lost some of his joy or the I don't want to say comic relief, even though that was what he was supposed to be, but he also was a main eventer, you know, near main event level guy, and there was a charm to him and an innocent, happy-go-lucky aspect that I think fans enjoyed, and part of that was playing off of Orton, who's somewhat the opposite. And when Orton was gone, and then Riddle got in this personal feud with Seth, and then they start scripting comments about how a judge won't let Riddle see his kids, it's like, and Riddle's all, you know, real serious, and kind of that joy is gone. I just felt they stripped away a lot of what made Riddle a pretty hot act earlier this year unnecessarily, and I thought it was bad judgment to do so. I just don't think you want viewers going, wait, a judge decided Riddle shouldn't be seeing his own kids? Maybe we need to know more about this guy. And this felt like it was an attempt on this show to move him back into that territory. Just bringing the bongos out. I mean, we got the, you know, obligatory bong marijuana joke. But it seemed like they were trying to get back to the old Riddle. And I think that's a good move. And I thought they took a step in the right direction in that regard, if you're someone who agrees with my premise, which is the more serious, volatile is not the word, but I don't know. There's just something about Riddle that just took away what I think people liked about him before. And this, you don't want him to be too corny. And you can argue maybe they went a little too far at times with him in that regard. But I thought tonight showed a self-awareness of that, or at least post-Seth, they're moving in a different direction.
Yeah, I think the stoner humor is going to have different effects on different people. You know, some people have a greater tolerance for it than others. Some people don't like it at all. And that's fine. But it's clearly something that comes very naturally to him, because I think that's a huge part of who he is and his personality. And so I think a fair amount of it is probably okay. But yeah, there's certainly, you know, if they swing too hard in the other direction and he's playing everything for laughs and bad weed jokes, that I'm sure I'll grow tired of it. But this felt like, he was just trying to be a little bit lighthearted and welcome back a character with some genuine enthusiasm. And I think it fit the mood of the segment that he was in.
Do you think Elias is ultimately better off as a babyface or a heel? They've kind of bounced around somewhat haphazardly with where they want him to be slotted. Do you think he's destined to be a face or a heel here, and which is better?
I think he's probably destined to be a heel, and I think that's the right place to put him. I think the best success that he had with Elias was as a musician who just can barely tolerate the people that he's playing music for, and constantly and snidely talking down to the audience and demanding, you know, their attention. That stuff worked for Elias. It might be difficult to do straight out of the gate when he's freshly back and people are more likely to cheer him than not, but it won't take them long to get back into a groove if they decide to go in that direction. And I think he performed better when he was in that role.
And I guess my last question for you is Mustafa Ali, are they doing an effective job pushing him given his history with WWE and how he's been sort of defined down but also left somewhat undefined at the same time? And yet he's really talented. He's somebody that I think people are rooting for to latch on to the fans and be a baby face that fans take seriously as a threat to some higher end wrestlers. Are they taking a good path, and is Mustafa doing his part?
Well, I think they're in a uniquely good position to do that with him. Seth Rollins, of course, is over and supremely talented, but he's also carrying a mid-card title, and he's in a unique position to start to build up some of these other talents that have languished and, you know, have suffered for, you know, either short or, like in Mustafa's case, long periods of time through stops and starts with different characters and different pushes and in and out of factions that didn't work and you know, the sort of those rapid fire complications that come or that came along with Vince McMahon's vision for, you know, how he was using people at the time. And he suffered greatly because of it. You know, there's probably been four or five different face to heel turns and character choices for him that just never quite took off. And so hopefully this is a step in providing him some consistency and a framework to build something on so that you actually know what you have in Mustafa Ali. You know, I it's hard to even say what the ceiling is for him, because I think we all recognize how talented he is in the ring, but he's never really been given that opportunity to be put into a position to shine as a character. And so hopefully this is the start of that. And I think they did at least a halfway decent job of putting him in position to where he feels like a credible threat to Seth Rollins at this point.
All right, well, we got the major players in that last segment covered. So let's pause, let's introduce the show, and then move on to live calls, emails, and other topics from Raw, including Crown Jewel hype, full steam ahead. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Monday, October 17th, 2022. And I'm Wade Keller, the host of the program. I am the founder of Pro Wrestling Torch, and pwtorch.com. We've got a paper copy print newsletter that started it all. And, of course, we're big into podcasting now, and we appreciate you joining us today, whether you're live streaming the show right after Raw at wadekellerpostshow.com or whether you've downloaded the show and are listening to us on your podcast app or through our website. We welcome you and encourage you to subscribe if you haven't yet. Just search Wade Keller in your podcast app, and you'll see a red and blue logo show up. This is our red logo show, our post shows with live call-ins, with a live call-in format after Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown every week, along with some best-of shows. And then our blue logo show features our weekly flagship, along with some best-of shows from 5 and 10 years ago, occasional interviews and pay-per-view previews, and other special formats that aren't the post-show format. So check that out, new content throughout the week on both feeds. And while you're at it, search PW Torch to subscribe to our third main feed with a different show every day of the week with a different specific theme on pro wrestling, including NXT, AEW, the indie scene. And the latest edition is the PW Torch Pastcast, looking back at a Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter from 30 years ago. Alex McDonald and Patrick Moynihan host that, and I have a blast going back to the early 1990s. The other voice you hear is Jake Barnett from ProWrestling.net. Jake, welcome back to the co-host chair here on a Monday.
Yeah, always a pleasure to be here, Wade. Thanks for having me.
I'm getting over a bit of a cold. I don't know if I hit it well last Wednesday and Friday when hosting the show, but if suddenly I'm not responding, it's because I'm hitting the mute button and having a little coughing fit. I'm feeling pretty good, but my ability to talk at length without needing to cough is not fully recovered yet. So I appreciate everybody bearing with me through a mild but somewhat annoying cold this past week. It's not easy being a podcaster, Jake.
No, it's good to have that mute button, though. Saves
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, colds are like, people can push through, but if you have to talk as much as I do, I don't know. People just send me get well cards. This is a big deal here, people, for a podcaster. All right, anyway, joking aside, I want to give out the phone number and encourage you to join the program. Our call-in number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. And when you call push 1 on your keypad, that flags you on our switchboard. That means we know you want to be brought onto the show. And we encourage first-time callers. Be shy if you're a long-time listener or a first-time listener or somewhere in between, and you got thoughts on Raw or you want to respond to anything we say. You do not need to agree with us. We invite and encourage opposing views or just other details maybe you picked up or speculation you have on what's coming up in the future. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. That's wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. And let us know what you thought of Raw. You don't have to listen live to be part of the mailbag segment. You can email during Raw, Dynamite, or SmackDown and then listen to the show at your convenience on demand. All right, let's speaking of phone calls, let's get to phone calls, and certainly we'll get to other topics also. We'll begin with, I believe it is Matt in Delaware, who's up first on the lineup tonight. Matt, thanks for calling. Welcome. What'd you think of Raw tonight?
I thought it was pretty good. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good. Thanks for asking.
All right. Yeah, I was going to talk about the main event a little bit, but you guys pretty much covered everything. You know, when I first saw Rollins and Ali segment earlier in the night, I was thinking this was basically just to make sure that Rollins was getting booed and, you know, have the crowd have a lot of heat on him for the match with Riddle. And then to me at that time, I felt like that was sort of defining Ali down because he got beat down in that segment. But then when it all came together at the end, it seems like possibly Ali's going to move forward and try to challenge Rollins for his title, which I think Rollins being in that position to have good matches with guys like Ali is a good role for him right now. The only thing was Ali said Lashley was going to give me an opportunity. And were we supposed to forget that he actually did give him an opportunity 3 weeks ago and beat him? I would have liked to seen a clean finish in that situation. But, separate of that, I really thought that the way that they brought back Corbin was probably the best way they could. They had JBL in there, you know, putting him over the entire time, you know, doing a really good heel work on commentary. I thought Patrick was better on commentary tonight. He was pretty funny in his bantering with Graves. It was pretty good back and forth. And Ziggler was a good opponent for Corbin to go up against in his first match back. So what do you guys think of the repackaging of Corbin?
Sure, yeah. Variety of things there that you brought up. Thanks, Matt. We haven't talked about Baron Corbin or repackaging yet. I am curious for your thoughts, Jake. We'll start with your take.
Well, I thought JBL had a very strong performance on the microphone. You know, he did a very nice bit of crowd work there, you know, going after Oklahoma, going after Rey Mysterio, you know, really putting over, you know, Baron Corbin and this reinvented version of him. I was a little surprised when he brought out Corbin that, you know, I guess the gear didn't seem to match the character more or less.
The same, yeah.
And that kind of distracted me even throughout the match, where it was just like, man, I feel like he showed up, but I already feel like he needs a visual like refresh of sorts. And I don't know if maybe he has other gears, you know, that are going to be better for this. But I was also surprised we didn't hear from him at all. You know, Corbin is actually a pretty talented talker, and I thought they gave JBL, you know, basically 100% of the oxygen in that segment. And then even during the match, you know, JBL was dominating the broadcast from the commentary desk. And so, you know, that, I guess if this is the one night he shows up and then, you know, Corbin sort of picks up the baton and carries it from here, then I'll probably change my mind. But I would have liked to hear something from Corbin in his own words to introduce his own character.
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing, if this is a one-off or if JBL is going to be a regular alongside Corbin, or if he was just sort of the launch point for the character. And I did think it was important to hear from Baron Corbin on the first week to get to establish from him, because he's been talking a lot, and he's been, I think, doing a good job as the down-and-out Corbin, the happy Corbin. And so for him to go back to Baron Corbin, I kind of needed to know where he's been and what the story is. And not that they can't explore it in the future, but it seemed like that would have been a week one thing to do, rather than have him, you know, beat Ziggler and have JBL do all the talking. I think it actually is as good of a talker as JBL is, it marginalized Corbin a little bit to sort of be subservient from the talking standpoint with him. So I thought that too. And I thought that about the outfit. I didn't think it was nearly like over the top enough. I think to get heel heat, you want to do something that's a little more memorable. And that just seemed like, you know, an indie wrestler with a budget trying to look professional, but it didn't really say anything to the fans about his character.
I was just going to say, I'm assuming that this Mr. Baron Corbin character is going to be something in the vein of what, you know, JBL was doing with his Wrestling God character. And we'll see how that pans out, you know, as the weeks go by. But yeah, as you were saying, having JBL do all the introducing and then have a 50-50 match with Dolph Ziggler, where I can't even recall the last time he's won anything on television. It seemed like I was getting mixed signals from the way that they debuted him, is all.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. JBL was a big star, and Triple H, Paul Levesque, seems to be wanting to bring back anybody and everybody to add depth to what had been a real shallow roster earlier this year in the lead up to Vince McMahon's retirement. So that's been one of his signatures, is let's just, you know, if someone's available, when we can find a role for them, let's do it, whether it's a DX reunion or the return of Braun Strowman or getting Ali back on TV, repackaging Elias back to his original character, all that stuff. You know, JBL kind of fits that pattern with Levesque of, hey, there might be some JBL fans out there, create some buzz. And, you know, with ratings down, viewership down, compared to a year ago up against Monday Night Football, you know, he's also, I think, looking for little hooks here and there to help out. Matt, back to you. I know you brought up a few things. Anything else you want us to respond to, or do you want to bring up something else new?
Well, I agree with you guys. Corbin's gear was terrible. And just something you said earlier about Riddle, I did like how they sort of had it more of the happy-go-lucky Riddle than the serious Riddle that they were portraying throughout the Rollins feud. I don't know what's up next for him. But also with the Miz and Loomis stuff, I thought the Miz segments throughout the night were very well done. And, you know, how he faked the accident and all that stuff. And then up until the point where he just ambushed Loomis, we still have no resolution on all that stuff. We don't know if Loomis is getting a contract or whatever, which I always thought was a little strange that Road Dogg or whoever was able to tell Miz and arrange for a contract for Loomis when they're not the ones who do that. But also Gargano's involvement in this, you know, teasing that he's going to, you know, out whatever happened between Miz and Loomis. Where do you think they're going with that? Do you think that they're going to resolve this Miz and Loomis stuff, or is Miz going to go into a program with Gargano? You know.
Yeah, yeah. So got it, Matt. Thanks. Yeah, I think did anything cross your mind, Jake, about what they want us to think happened with Miz and Dexter that Miz just needs to be forward about, even if it could cancel him and leave him homeless? I mean, the mind can go strange places. I don't know if WWE has something specific they want people thinking about, or the point is it's real vague.
Yeah, my first thought was like, am I forgetting an appearance from The Miz on NXT where he was involved with an angle with The Way in down in NXT? But I couldn't recall anything off the top of my head. But they did make a point, you know, shortly after Dexter's debut, where he went back down to NXT and sort of left a, did he leave a note or a love letter for Indy Hartwell? But that was my first thought. It's like, are they going to try to put some piece of The Way back together on the main roster now that they're teasing the fact that Gargano has a long history with him and there's more than meets the eye about his character? You know, maybe The Miz didn't wrong Dexter Loomis specifically. Maybe he wronged Indy Hartwell in some way that we're not aware of, and that's why he's after revenge. Or, you know, there's a lot of potential directions here. But given that The Miz is involved in a lot of kind of soap opera style WWE stories, I have to imagine that we could be getting, you know, Loomis and Indy against Miz and Maryse, or some form of Johnny Gargano and Candice LeRae against Miz and there's a lot of potential spiderwebs where this can go, but it seems to involve, you know, what happened with The Way and NXT in some way, shape, or form.
Did you have any problem with advertising the match and not delivering?
I mean, it was a little bit of a bummer. It was an odd stipulation to begin with. And then, you know, the execution of the assault left a lot to be desired. Like, The Miz was clearly just hitting the floor with the chair, and the camera caught a lot of daylight between the chair and Dexter Loomis, and so it looked pretty bad. That stood out to me more than not delivering the match. I think they gave the story involving the match a lot of time on the show, and so I wasn't too offended by it. But if this had been the only thing we saw of Miz and Loomis all night, then it would have been quite a bummer.
Yeah, they kind of made you think maybe the match won't happen because Miz is faking an injury early, and that might have prepared people for the possibility of there not being a match, and maybe that was part of what they were doing. It also just was our chance for Miz to be on TV for a few segments. I'm intrigued if there's some backstory with Gargano and Dexter from NXT that gets brought into this, and I, like you, don't recall specifics of that. But if not, it's weird to even imagine what Gargano is implying that Miz pushed back on, but in a way that implied maybe Miz is defensive because it's true. That Miz did something that will get him canceled that Dexter knows about or was part of or is upset with. So, I mean, I hope they pay this off, and I hope it's, you know, appropriate and believable. I wanted the clues to match, but I want there to be an actual payoff that feels like everyone can move on afterwards, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, it doesn't have to be something really lewd or something. I don't think that really fits what they do most often with The Miz. You know, even in his more serious programs, he's very clearly a character that's been geared towards comic relief. And so, you know, maybe there's something embarrassing for The Miz here. And that seems way more likely than him doing something completely out of character. He's really, despite the fact that he's a heel, more often than not, he's portrayed as a family man. I don't know if they'd want to completely blow that up.
Yeah, I think you have to link Miz's on-air character with what people know about him, especially with the reality show. Although if Gargano and Candice want to move in like next to or across the street from Miz and Maryse, and they want to do a whole like neighbor rival theme to the next season of Miz and Mrs., you know, I might be on board for that. That might be fun. They can Miz can yell about you know, them raking leaves, and they rake leaves, and then the leaves from Gargano and Candice blow into their yard. That's like reality TV conflict right there.
Yeah, I can just see the ratings pouring in while you're describing it. With, yeah.
Oh, you? I mean, haven't you watched reality TV? That's like half the time when it's.
Oh, I understand. Yeah, it's definitely not my cup of tea, but there are people who really dig it.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, you know, a Miz and Mrs. reality theme that involves a rivalry with the neighbors would be something that innocuous. It would be leaves blowing into his yard, and they just turn it into a big thing. I'm not like making a serious pitch or advocating for it. I'm just saying that's probably what it would be. So decide if you're excited based on that. All right, Matt, any closing words from you?
Not much. I again with the Styles putting over Dom, getting rolled up after the interference from Judgment Day. It's like how many. I understand what Judgment Day is. It's just how many matches are they going to have that ended interference and that Rhea Ripley helps Dom out? Why can't he lose clean? And then other than that, just your thoughts on how Kevin Patrick did in his second night as the full-time Raw announcer. Other than that, thanks for having me on, and go VIP.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it. I guess I'll start with Kevin Patrick. Jake, your opinion on him after a couple of weeks doing play-by-play on Raw working with Corey Graves?
It's a small sample size. I can say, you know, that he's been relatively inoffensive to me. Like, I think Jimmy Smith was growing on me very slowly after a long period of me not really having much of an opinion on him. And I think Patrick is growing on me a bit faster. I can't really say that he's stood out to me in an incredibly positive way where it feels like he's adding a lot of useful information to the show. But I think he does a very competent job of directing traffic between the louder personalities that end up joining them at the commentary table. And so I'll say, you know, so far, so good. But I don't have a strong opinion in either direction at this point.
Michael Cole announced at Extreme Rules that he and Corey Graves are the permanent pay-per-view announcers. So Patrick's not going to have the pressure to become a pay-per-view caliber big match play-by-play announcer at this point. Cole's got that duty 100%. All the big matches on PLEs are going to be called by Cole. So the standard for what Patrick needs to do is actually different, because a TV show where, yeah, there's people on commentary, there's commercial breaks, there's things you're plugging, there's other storylines. It's a different kind of calling of the action. And so far, so good. I don't think he's great, but, you know, Raw and SmackDown, part of what they do is sort of like, you just want to hang out for 2 or 3 hours with this person. And that's part of it. And in that sense, Kevin Patrick is affable. He's nice. He doesn't upset Corey Graves like Jimmy Smith did, and deservedly so. There were things Jimmy Smith said that were, you know, just showed his lack of knowledge or lack of seriousness to his craft, and it irked Corey Graves. And that can make things uncomfortable sometimes for viewers. And I just think that's not going to be the case. I think Graves will, you know, give Patrick a little bit of a hard time, but be more respectful than he was to Byron. And Patrick will be a good foil, but not just a complete pushover. And as far as calling the action, I mean, he's been solid. I think viewers will like Kevin Patrick because he comes across as someone who's an actual genuine fan of the product. And I think the impression, and I'm just speculating here, tell me if you think I'm crazy, Jake, is I think people got the impression Jimmy Smith during commercial breaks was checking his phone for the scores of other events going on Monday nights in sports. That he wasn't just like really glued to what was going on Raw. He wasn't the student of the game with passion for the product. And, you know, he was hired because of his non-pro wrestling background at a time, and that was a thing that Khan was big on to try to, impress network executives that WWE was, you know, mainstream and not just pro wrestling. And obviously Paul Levesque's less worried about that and has the power to make some changes. It's possible Nick Khan changed his mind too on that. Do you kind of agree with my assessment there, Jake?
Yeah, in large part. I think, Jimmy Smith just, you know, as you've mentioned at times, came across a bit disconnected. You know, he didn't have the passion for the product. And I think his post-WWE interviews just kind of reflected that, you know, in him, you know, just sort of explaining, you know, where he came from, how he ended up in WWE, how by and large it was a very good experience, but, you know, they wanted to go in a different direction, and so did he for the most part. And so, you know, I think there's plenty to criticize Jimmy Smith about. I think he did much better than Adnan Virk. You know, I mean, it was a clear improvement in that regard. But there wasn't over time in the months that he spent covering the show, I didn't get the impression as time went on that he became more and more enamored with what he was covering. You know, it seemed like he tolerated it. And hopefully with Kevin, we'll get somebody who's invested not only, you know, in the wrestling in the ring, but also, you know, the stories, because I think that's where the best announcers separate themselves from the mediocre ones is they, you know, they themselves get invested in the stories and the characters and react accordingly. And so we'll see what he's, you know, instructed to do from the production aspect of things. But I'm cautiously optimistic about the future of the Raw announced team.
Yeah, yep. By the way, Sam in Nebraska, you are on deck, but I do want to address Matt's other topic before I brought up Jimmy Smith, and that was AJ Styles losing to Dominik. I'm curious, Jake, what you think of Dominik beating AJ under any circumstances, and are these circumstances okay? And how did Dominik look, in your opinion, against AJ? With the idea being AJ can have a good match just about anyone, but Dominik's really green, and this was a pretty big test to go this long against anyone live on television.
Well, I don't know precisely how long we've been watching Dominik in active competition on WWE TV, but it feels like are we getting pretty close to 2 years?
Wade, that feels about right. Yeah, 2 years is kind of the over-under.
And I don't know. I don't feel like he's dramatically improved in that 2 year period. Like you see him making, you know, mistakes and being out of position and, you know, staring down referees during pinfalls for kickouts and making the kind of mistakes that you kind of expect to see, you know, when you're watching green talent in NXT. And that's fine. If he's green and that's just the nature of learning the craft, that is what it is. But I don't know that it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know if he's really ready to be in the position that he's in, being in a prominent faction and wrestling people like AJ Styles and picking up victories. I mean, it's like the best that I can really say is it's like a mediocrity in the ring. I think his character work has improved dramatically since he turned heel and he's been given a little bit of something to do, you know, from a promo perspective. But man, I just can't get past the fact that, you know, you're in there with AJ Styles, a veteran who seems to have good matches with just about everybody, and it looked clumsy at times, which is a rare thing for AJ.
I think the his habit of adjusting his waistband while he's flat on his back waiting to be hit with a top rope move by AJ, and there at least one or two other times that he was adjusting his waistband, kind of pulling up while he was selling. It's like if you adjust your hair when you're supposedly knocked out, which some wrestlers do. It's just it takes me out of the moment. And your observations of him staring as the ref is counting Yeah, that doesn't look good. Although in defense of him, Ric Flair did that all the time too, and it drove me nuts. Back in the 1980s, Flair would always just look wide-eyed at the referee counting. There's less of it for good reason. It looks tacky, especially with high-def cameras and close-ups these days. Not to do that. So yeah, I mean, I think Dominic has improved, but I think everything you said is right in that he's not like, I don't think anybody's watching going, this guy is progressing at a rate in the ring that he's going to be a star. He's sort of, I think, kind of in the middle zone of wrestlers who get, because of who their dads are, get TV time. I don't think he's an embarrassment, but he's still green. And yeah, there's, I mean, mediocre is sort of a victory for him in a way, and AJ brought that out of him. But I just think his character is over right now, and he and Ripley have good chemistry. And to me, I think he was just good enough against AJ to not have people going, oh, God, you know, you can't put him in the ring anymore. You know, you're exposing him when you put him in a singles match. But not everybody's as good as AJ, so that's an issue too.
Yeah, I might have shortened the time he was in the ring then. Like, I think this is like almost a 15-minute TV match.
Yeah.
Maybe if you cut that down to 8 or 10 or something, maybe he doesn't feel as much pressure to go out there and have some kind of work rate spectacular. Because you can see the effort is there. He's trying hard. It's just the execution isn't quite as sharp as you'd want it to be.
As much heel heat as he gets, I don't think he gets, like, smart fan hostile go-away heat. Like, I think people are like, he seems like he's pretty cool. You know, it seems like he's an okay guy. We're not rooting against him. And you know, there's some second-generation wrestlers who have had that kind of heat. I don't know if Garrett Bischoff did with everybody, but, you know, that was somebody who was like, oh, God, you know, you're obviously getting pushed because of who you are, or going back to Eric Watts, a famous early 90s example. Who jumps out, Jake, to you as the wrestler who was who had family in the business that fans really resented just the mere presence of?
Did you already mention Greg Gagne? Did I skip over it? That's a long time ago, but that's the one who jumps to mind for me the most.
Old Guard fans looked down on him, but he was a good, solid, decent worker. I mean, Steve Austin and I have talked on his podcast about Greg's, like, fired-up comebacks and hot tags and you know, his promos were really believable and earnest and intense. And I think he had enough traits. I think as he got into his 30s and stopped hitting the gym at all and just didn't look the part, I think there was a little more heat on him there. I didn't live through the earlier Zagania, but the old guard definitely made fun of him. But I was part of crowds that, you know, were the vast majority of fans were super into him. And him and Jim Brunzell as the high flyers against Jesse Ventura and Adrian Adonis, the East-West connection, among other opponents. And it was a different era, too, where I think fans sort of were like, hey, if he's on TV, he must be good. I don't know if there was a lot of go-away heat in that era. I guarantee if you fast-forward 25 years, he'd get that kind of heat, though. You know, I mean, he would have been in trouble.
Yeah, there's also the David Flairs and the Wes Briscoes and the Eric Watts and Sean Stasiak. Like, there's probably a handful that you could come up with that immediately just turn the audience off.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if anyone else listening thinks of anybody, drop us a line. Wade Keller Podcast at pewtorch.com. Also, give us a call if you're listening live. Our number is 347-215-8558. All right, up next, as noted, we'll go to Sam in Nebraska next. Sam, good to hear from you. What's in your mind about Raw tonight?
Another name I would throw out is Scott Putzke, who is also just super generic. The one thing I wanted to talk about is kind of struck me as I was because I hadn't watched Raw since I'd gone to Raw and did a call in, you know, a couple months ago, but I watched a fair amount of tonight. And as I was watching the with Bailey on commentary during the women's match, I did find it interesting. Like, I've mainly felt like since SummerSlam, the whole Bailey act just hasn't quite been clicking. I just don't know if they have a real good idea or what her thesis statement is on who she is. But I didn't I felt tonight as she seems to be a little reinvigorated by Candice LeRae being around, and maybe she's just excited to finally be working with her again. And I was just curious what your guys' thoughts were on that.
I thought Bailey had a little more spring in her step as a character tonight, Jake. But not enough to leap off the screen and be like, ah, Bailey's back, and now I'm really into her. But it did seem like she was a little more engaged and just kind of turned up the volume a little bit on her character. How about you?
Yeah, I don't think they've overcome that initial hurdle of establishing, like, what her philosophy is, you know, why she put together this faction, why it was so important for her to do that, you know, what she felt like she, you know, because to call yourself damage control and assert that you're taking control of the division, you know, what about your previous, life in wrestling made you feel like you didn't have control, and what are you rebelling against? And I really don't think they've nailed that as far as the character work is concerned. Because, you know, most of the time she's going out there and she's cutting promos and doing, you know, crowd work, talking about local sports teams and whatnot. And it hasn't been a home run for me personally.
Maybe the absence of that was nice. Just the absence of that was nice.
Yeah. So I think if they're moving away from that and they plan on having her establish, you know, why after a year off, this is why, you know, this is the team that she put together to come back and take control of the division. And this is my mission. You know, once I'm champion, this is how and why I'm going to turn this division into my, you know, my domain, my vision, why I've spent a year,
yeah,
you know, rebuilding my knee from meatloaf into a human knee again, so I could, you know, come back and wrestle. You know, why did you do that? You know, that took an incredible amount of effort. And so,
yeah.
You know, there's some of that I think is still missing, but I do agree that she did a better job tonight. Her energy level was higher. You know, the backstage promo where everybody got a chance to talk, EO and Dakota and eventually Bailey. I think they, you know, they did a nice job of, you know, of framing where they're going next with them. They, in general, I think they did a better job of connecting the two shows. You know, there's several segments on this show that are promoting things that are happening on SmackDown, for instance. But yeah, it's fine. It's still missing something, but I think it is improving over time, and hopefully they'll get their legs underneath them and damage control eventually. I think that's just, they immediately came back, and I think they anticipated having both Bianca and Becky Lynch for that faction to play off of, and Becky got hurt, and I think they're maybe waiting for her to you know, come back and maybe add some balance to the division, and maybe things will start to take off again once they get a little bit more promo time in the ring together.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment to bring up, is how much of a, you know, detour in what Bailey had worked out and what excited her occurred when Becky got hurt. Sam, back to you for follow-up or new topic.
Yeah, no, I mean, those are a lot of my thoughts, too. The only other thing I kind of had thought, and maybe I'm just not remembering things properly, but I did find it very interesting how they kind of made a pitch to go and attend Crown Jewel, and I don't really remember that happening before. I don't know if you guys remember that happening, but I did find that kind of interesting, you know, pitching for, you know, hey, you got 2 weeks to put together a trip to Riyadh, which just seems kind of almost absurd to me. So other than that, thank you for all that you do.
Thank you, Sam. Appreciate it. Yeah, and it also jumped out to me that Corey Graves, like, became the travel at the what's the word I'm looking for? Travel advocate for Saudi Arabia. I can't wait to get there and have breakfast and watch the sunrise. It's so beautiful. And it's just, I mean, unless he's like being forced to say that, it just feels like he's volunteering this. And I mean, it just feels tone deaf. Like, do they not understand like how people feel about Saudi Arabia, and that it's already, you know, the nickname of the shows is Blood Money around here. And the, you know, I mean, they just, you know, the Saudi regime and Putin are conspiring to raise gas prices before the election to try to swing votes in a direction of an administration and a political party they think could be more favorable to them, especially Putin and his awful invasion of Ukraine, a sovereign nation. And all this is going on, and then Corey Graves is like a booster of taking a vacation because of the beautiful sunrises. It's just like, I mean, come on, WWE. Come on, Corey Graves. It's bad enough that you're just talking Saudi Arabia and Riyadh, you know, as opposed to feeling some semblance of shame beforehand about being boosters. It's one thing and I'm not advocating that it's okay. I'm not saying it's okay, but it's one thing to go there and take their money and put on a show. But when you start being a booster for it being a vacation destination and touting it like it's this, you know, wonderful place, it's just like, I mean, there were people booing the Crown Jewel logo a couple of years ago after the Crown Prince was responsible for the butchering of that Washington Post columnist. And here they are just acting like, well, it's been long enough. It's all okay now. Jake, your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think they're ever going to fight off the stigma, you know, of these Saudi Arabian shows. It was a clear money grab when they initially signed the contract, and now I think they're four years into a 10-year deal with these Crown Jewel shows, and I think they're, you know, I don't know if they have an opportunity to cease doing business with them anytime. I think that would probably torpedo their stock price, unfortunately. But when the geopolitical heat gets too hot, is there a potential that this could be put on pause? I just don't know. But it seems very, very scummy every time it comes up a couple times a year. And
you want to feel that you want a little sense that they're ashamed of taking the money, as opposed to just being boosters.
Yeah, I agree, but I don't think we're going to see that reflected on the screen. I don't know how people in the company privately feel about this. You know, it may be that 85% of them are disgusted that they have to do it twice a year. I just have no idea, but I don't think they're going to risk running afoul of the Saudis because that money is just a huge part of their bottom line at this point.
Yeah, sadly. I mean, they don't need the money. They could go about earning customer money and business the old-fashioned way, and not taking, gigantic paydays from regimes like Saudi Arabia in an effort for Saudi Arabia to cleanse themselves and make themselves seem like they're a legit, cool part of the international community and a beautiful place. They don't have to be that for the money. Well, maybe they do have to be that for the money, but they shouldn't have agreed to that aspect of it.
Yeah, I don't like the fact that that they're constantly, seemingly promoting Saudi Arabia as a place that's, it's very similar to traveling to Europe or Australia or, any other nation in the world. It's certainly not from a political perspective.
And from a brand perspective for WWE, I think it's dangerous. I think a lot of people think differently about them because of this. People who are, read up on this or just have cursory knowledge of how dirty this money should feel to them. And wrestlers are given the speech, hey, we're making progress, and it was, it was wrapped in, hey, look at these, the women are going to wrestle, it's going to inspire girls everywhere, and you get to do this charity event, this event with kids, and it's going to inspire them and bring smiles to their faces. And I know wrestlers who are sold on that, this is a step in the right direction, even if it's a, quote, imperfect country. You still have to be careful how you portray things on TV.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because I'm sure the wrestlers are going to these shows and they're dealing with the fans, and and these fans are not all, part of the regime.
No,
right?
This is not against the fans who love WWE and want to go. I mean, there's a lot of – obviously, there's mostly the people are just – they're just people in a country, who want to be entertained. This is not trying to – like the idea that, oh, but you're taking this experience away from the fans who just want to be there and have fun. That's not the point. I mean, they'll be fine. The fans can be fine. Their lives can go on if they don't get to see WWE in person. The issue is not, that. It's just WWE, trying to legitimize this regime and make it seem more mainstream than what that country deserves based on their treatment of women, their treatment of the LGBT community, you know, their obvious political move in recent weeks to cut off oil supply so gas prices go up before the election. And so, you know, people who don't get read up on it blame people who have nothing to do with it. It's like that kind of maneuvering. You know, you can't just pretend it's some neutral country and they're just there for the fans. Because if they were, just WWE go there and sell tickets and take the ticket revenue. But they got paid in a way out of proportion amount of money for a reason to go there. And it took a lot of money for WWE to go there. And so they can't, you know, WWE can't pretend, and the wrestlers frankly can't pretend, that if it wasn't for the gigantic out of proportion paydays, that they'd be proud to go there either. But if they were going there and they're just getting regular everyday paydays based on ticket sales, that's one thing. And that, you know, that'd be controversial in and of itself, but the fact that they are getting paid so much money per show is because of how controversial it is to do business there.
Absolutely. It's just, I think when people hear you criticize a regime, sometimes they take it as you're criticizing, you know, the entire country and its population. Yeah. And there is a separation that needs to be declared there. I'm certainly not. I have no beef with people in Saudi Arabia.
No.
They're political leaders, and many of my own political leaders in this country, I take great, great exception to some of their policies.
Yes, there might be some people I don't like in Saudi Arabia, but I have no reason to believe it'd be a higher percentage of people there than many other countries. They seem like good people who are enjoying the WWE product, and that's certainly not the target of my criticism. All right, let's go. I think Sam, we finished up with Sam. Let me confirm. Sam, are you done with us?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I mean, I a lot of what you're echoing is just what I think. So, nope. Have a good night.
Yeah, okay. Cool, thanks. I appreciate it. All right, you can give us a call, 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. We'll go next to Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, thanks so much for calling. What have you got for us tonight?
First question is on Seth Rollins. He said he's going to be the greatest United States champion of all time, or had the best reign as champion. So who do you think, out of all the years the U.S. title, has had the best reign? Is it Goldberg, Sting, Lex Luger, or somebody else?
None of the three you mentioned. Not even close. Jake, does anybody come to mind? I mean, I would think Rick Steamboat, Greg Valentine. I don't know. I mean,
In recent memory, probably John Cena.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Roddy Piper had a heck of a run. Eddie Guerrero, Booker T. Yeah, there's plenty of people that you could point to that had excellent runs with the United States Championship. But I guess if you want to point to something in the last, 20 years, probably Cena with the Open Challenge is probably the most memorable it's been on WWE TV.
Yeah. I think who else? Cena's a really good pick. I think who had a long reign? Did Dean Ambrose have a long reign?
At one time, I think he did when it was on the SmackDown brand and he was over there. Yeah. He did hold it for a considerable amount of time, but I wouldn't put that one above what Cena was able to accomplish. He held that title for quite a long time, and then he essentially made Kevin Owens when he dropped the title to him. So,
yeah, I think Cesaro had a nice run.
MVP had a long run when shortly after the company merged.
Right.
I think he held the title for almost a year. So, yeah, there's quite a few people who have had fairly memorable U.S. title runs.
But, Ryan, you brought up, names from the past like Lex Luger, and that brings us back to WCW days. Rick Rude had a long reign with U.S. title. I think he had some good matches during that reign. Nikita Koloff and – was Nikita and Magnum TA, they fought over the U.S. title, right? Was that their best of 7 series for the U.S. title?
Yeah, absolutely.
Those two. Those are some names. Ryan, what else or any follow-up on that or a different topic?
Second question is on this AJ Styles, Good Brothers feud against Judgment Day. Do you think they're going to bring in a woman to help with facing Judgment Day because they can't really hit Rhea Ripley, or do you think they're all sort of afraid to bring in a woman because it might cause some issues at home? Because I know it caused at least one of those men a divorce with Dana Brooke years ago.
I don't think having an on-air female in a faction should be disqualified based on, you know, the idea that somebody would be jealous. I mean, you don't have to be a TV character in a faction on television to be someone that a man in a wrestling company would cheat with. I don't think that increases the odds all that much. Just if you're a part of an on-air faction with someone, I don't think that increases dramatically your odds of sleeping with them. So I would hope that wouldn't be an issue. What do you think about the OC adding a woman to, I guess you'd be doing it only just for the feud with the Judgment Day, which might seem like, you know, too big of a step, but maybe they could just temporarily align with someone, I guess.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who would even fit. The women's roster is pretty
thin. Dana Brooke.
Yeah, I mean, I guess she just doesn't feel like a threat to Rhea in any serious way. I don't think anybody on the women's roster.
A repackaged Doudrop, a repackaged Nikki, probably a little more serious answer.
I guess I could buy a repackaged Doudrop as Piper Niven as being a threat to Rhea Ripley, but they'd have to do some work establishing her. And I guess I could do the same for Nikki Cross, formerly Nikki Storm. You know, I think there's certainly talent that hasn't been mined there with the most recent use of her character, but nothing that I think they could put together between now and Crown Jewel to where it would feel super credible. But I get the impression that this is just going to be a 3-on-3 match, and Rey is just going to be the outside. Interference aspect of it. I guess if, you know, depending on how long they have Edge out for an injury timeline, you know, Beth Phoenix could certainly be a part of that as well.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Ryan, what else?
Any question on Elias and the keyboard, especially since my brother used to be a keyboard player in the band Nemesis years ago. Does Elias actually play the keyboard, like other wrestlers that played the guitar in the past, like The Rock and Steve Austin? Are they just dubbing in music to look like sort of like what they did with Ashley Simpson on like Saturday Night Live when she got exposed for lip sync? I don't know if that could actually happen in WWE where someone got exposed doing that too, like Saturday Night Live.
Well, he really plays guitar, so I suspect he also plays keyboard. I mean, a lot of people who learn musical instruments learn piano enough to, you know, practice and be functional. But it was different having him out there, not with his guitar. I didn't pay attention to what he was doing on the keyboard. Jake, any thoughts on that?
You know, I can't say I paid close enough attention to catch whether they could have been dubbing it in or not, but I'm inclined to say that he was probably actually playing the keyboard.
Yeah, yeah. Ryan, anything else, or is that all for us?
Final question is on Dominic Mysterio. When do you actually see him wrestling Rey, since they're on different brands? It's like Dominic does somehow sneak his way on with, like, say, a draft, or somehow, like, get behind Triple H's back and sneak in on the roster somehow, or do you think it's going to be a long time before we actually see that match?
Yeah. Jake, I don't know that we need to see Rey against Dominic, do we? I mean, is that going to be believable if they have, like, a knockdown drag-out fight? Or does it seem like, hey, it's pro wrestling, they got to go there, there's money in it, people would be curious?
You know, maybe they end up on opposite sides of a four games match. Clearly they'll probably both end up being in the Royal Rumble, so you'll get something there. But yeah, I don't know if it rises to the occasion of being like a WrestleMania match or something. Yeah, I could definitely find something better for Rey to do. Dominic, I guess I just assumed that he'd be involved with Judgment Day somehow. But yeah, I don't personally feel like there's a lot of anticipation for a Rey and Dominic match unless they're know, they're just going to allow Ray to you know, extract his revenge, or maybe convince his son to turn back to the light or something along those lines. But I think splitting them up and moving them to opposite brands makes it more likely that they just want to let them develop separately, because them being on screen together, you know, with how they were proceeding with that story, I think it was actually hurting both of them long term.
Yeah, I think it was good to split them apart. Okay, we have run through the callers, so if you're listening and you want to jump right on board, you can push 1 on your keypad or call us, 347-215-8558. Still some topics we haven't gotten to, so we'll go to the mailbag first. John in Tennessee says, I have really enjoyed the WWE product since Triple H took over, but something had to be done with this Seth Rollins character. He's supposed to be a heel, but he comes out seeking cheers during his entrance and panders to the crowd for cheers at the start of all his promos. He then goes back and forth between face and heel during promos. How is anyone supposed to get over in a program with him? To me, it seems like he is the most incoherent character on WWE TV. Your thoughts? Thanks for all the great content. Everyone, go VIP. Thank you for that kind word, John. Jake, yeah, I thought it was kind of weird where Seth was like thanking the people who are behind him, but, you know, telling the people who haven't been, you know, go to hell or whatever he said. It's almost like he's acknowledging the cheers and kind of encouraging them and, you know, conducting the orchestra when the crowd is cheering, singing a song. If I'm his opponent and I'm a babyface, it seems to kind of undercut things. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess it seems like they are trying to play some kind of morally gray area with Seth Rollins. And personally, I don't think WWE has a great track record of doing that. You know, and they haven't really indicated that he's like a full-on like narcissist or sociopath or one of those, you know, sort of categories where it's like a genuine like personality disorder. It just, you know, it seems like he's just playing this character that, you know, is morally compromised, but also genuinely loves the attention that he gets from fans. And I think it does present a challenge to the people who are facing him, but I think it's solvable by having these babyface characters that come up against Seth legitimately target his insecurities and his past failures and things along those lines to really get under his skin. Because when we saw that with Riddle, you saw him, you know, Seth as a character turn much darker, and I think that played better. But yeah, it's a tough position for them to be in, because he, you know, the fans love to chant, and WWE loves embracing, you know, fan chants, but sometimes that stuff does end up working against you in a way from a character standpoint. So unless they're going to have him legitimately play up the idea that he's some sort of like personality disorder or something, it's best to pick a lane and stick with it.
Yeah, it's awkward when the crowd is singing your song, and you know, they tried to combat that with Riddle saying you're really singing bro, and that's not exactly going to carry over into other feuds. So it's tough, you know. I mean, they could change his music if they really wanted him to be a heel, but I think WWE likes anything that involves the crowd singing along and playing along and getting into something like that. I think they see it as a net positive, even if it goes against the grain of the image that the fans, you know, hate this guy. So now I wouldn't say he's a tweener, but he's sort of like they're just okay with people being behind him. My instinct in WWE would be to try to get the fans turned against him entirely and find a way to do so, to get into, you know, psychologically make people feel foolish for singing his song, or I don't know. I mean, it's a tough situation, but because if you change his music, you're losing something that's part of the fan experience, kind of like Jericho with Judas, and the fans weren't happy last week when, you know, he came out to a different song, and Canada's like, wait a second, we paid tickets because we wanted to have that moment, so we're just going to start it ourselves. So you can end up kind of being the bad guy in a meta way as a promoter if you take that away.
Yeah, I think they need to find somebody for him to work with that the crowd is legitimately behind, that can point out his character flaws, that gives the fans the justification that they need to fully turn on Seth Rollins. And he's got to play his role as well by, you know, doing some very, you know, purposefully dastardly things in return. And maybe the right person for that is Kevin Owens. I don't know who else jumps to mind on the Raw side who isn't particularly wrapped up in a feud, but Kevin has been gone from TV, so I don't know if he's nursing an injury or what's going on there.
Yeah. Before I get into another email here, Jake, let's take a moment to have you talk about what you do for ProWrestling.net and how people can follow you on social media.
Yeah, so over at ProWrestling.net, I am a, I guess, podcaster as well as a television reviewer. Normally, I cover the Wednesday night Dynamite show for AEW. That's on Tuesday nights this week, but you can also occasionally find me reviewing WWE SmackDown if scheduling requires it. And then I also appear with Jason Powell on the weekly .NET weekly audio show and pay-per-view audio recaps for both WWE and AEW pay-per-views, which are available for .NET members. So if you're interested in hearing that stuff from Jason and I, you can check out pwmembership.net for all of the membership sign-up information. And you can also find me on Twitter, at BarnettJake, with two T's.
Very good. All right. Speaking of Twitter, you can follow me on Twitter, at TheWadeKeller, pro wrestling and other stuff. And you can also follow our brand, Just Pro Wrestling, content, at PWTorch, and follow our YouTube channel at youtube.com/PWTorch. All right, let's see. Email from Zach in Texas. Gentlemen, I need a big bottle of Pepto-Bismol after what I just watched on Raw. The fact that a living legend like AJ Styles had to lower himself to wrestling someone with as little talent as Dominic Mysterio is insulting enough. Sure, AJ spent upwards of 85% of the match whooping Dom's ass, but it's all moot because Dom won. AJ Styles, a legend who shared the ring with Samoa Joe, Kurt Angle, and Sting, was pinned by a walking ad for nepotism. It's a freaking joke. AJ Styles deserves better than that. 2 years in, and Dom's entire offense consisted of punches, kicks, and the weakest Three Amigos in history. And that guy beat one of the best wrestlers in the world. It's just wrong. Another head-scratcher is this JBL-Corbin pairing. This doesn't feel like a good role for JBL, and the gimmick feels about 6 years too late for Corbin. He's not new. We know who he is and what he can do, and I don't think he's going to get any more over. Frankly, I'm almost getting a rockabilly vibe with this whole future wrestling god thing. Zach in Texas. So, two topics we covered, but Zach brings up a couple points on each. One, I think Dom getting a win on AJ was meant to, in a storyline sense, be, the heel cheated. You know, he is not better than AJ. That was a lucky win. That kind of fan reaction, which exists out there, even in this era. And also a meta sense of what Dominic's getting a tainted win over AJ and get kind of the fans who are, you know, reacting to the booking to be upset by that also. Now, you got to be careful. It doesn't lead into the company getting heat, but Dominic's got heat, and I think he's doing enough as a character where getting a total fluke, tainted, not serious win over AJ for him to incessantly brag about is fine with me. I just don't – I mean, if this was a clean win by Dominic where they put him over and try to make it seem like, you know, this guy is – you know, Dominic is really good. He just beat the legend in AJ Styles clean – and out-wrestled him. I mean, that's more of a problem, but that's not what this finish was. Jake?
Yeah, no, I think we're in agreement on that. I mean, I'm not advocating that, you know, Dom, you know, be the guy who is the next challenger for a championship anywhere up and down the card at this point, but I don't know if you can, kind of put the brakes on what they're attempting to do with this sort of faction conflict at this point. It doesn't really make any sense for AJ Styles to just beat the tar out of Dominic for 15 minutes, control 85 to 90% of the match, and then get a win when they're attempting to, you know, make it at least appear that Judgment Day is the this faction of young wolves, so to speak, that are trying to take over Raw. So I think the finish makes sense given the context of the story that they're telling. And I think you're supposed to be angry, like you said, that he cheated to pick up a win on a guy who had just dominated him for the previous 15 minutes. And so it works on both levels, both from, you know, the story they're telling on screen, as well as that meta level where people, you know, sort of stare at the tea leaves and try to determine the quality of the booking based on their own preferences. And so I guess, you know, you can get too cute with that and end up upsetting both groups of fans, but I think they've at least earned enough goodwill with the fact that the booking logic has been fairly sound for the past couple of months that I'm not terribly concerned that this is going to result in AJ taking multiple TV losses that completely tank his credibility or something.
Yeah, yeah. As far as Corbin goes, anything to add to that? Other than I think Zach's comments back up what we said earlier, which is it would have been good to hear from Corbin to fend off the idea that maybe this is an awkward fit because we just know Baron Corbin too much. And we had a really good backstory to why Baron Corbin, you know, went from down and out to happy. So, you know, we're kind of in, how did they meet? Who approached whom? What's the inspiration for Corbin linking up with JBL? And I just think we needed to hear from Corbin on this. And I'm not saying they can't just, you know, do that next week and all will be fine. But certainly as we stand now, it's not like I think this real compelling return. And I think it could have been if Corbin felt more like JBL's equal on the mic, if not the alpha, who brought JBL, you know, who brought JBL in to give him advice and get him back on track, but still kind of was the alpha personality that he has been at different times prior to this.
Well, Corbin's been off TV for, I don't know, at least a month. And
yeah,
I think the last time we saw him, he was getting into JBL's limo, you know, after a segment on SmackDown where I want to say it was Madcap Moss or somebody had embarrassed him yet again in the ring. Or maybe it was Ricochet. I can't recall exactly. But essentially, you know, I anticipated that when he showed back up that he would either be with JBL or there would be some sort of JBL influence on the rebirth of his character. But the way that this was presented, it was very strange. I guess what it boiled down to me was JBL talked up, you know, this new character who was going to be this modern iteration of the wrestling god, and then, you know, Corbin walks out in what looks like a modified basketball uniform, essentially, and wearing a hat, and he doesn't have anything to say, and then he wrestles a 50-50 match with a guy who, I mean, nobody expects to win on television anymore. You know, Ziggler has not been treated particularly well by the booking for a considerable amount of time. And so it just left a kind of a weird taste in your mouth about, like, okay, you know, you got this new iteration of a guy who at times has been a dominant character on television, doesn't have a whole lot to say, and he didn't have a particularly convincing win. And so, yeah, it's a tough situation for Corbin. I mean, it's not to say that they can't rebound next week with a suitably hot angle or something, but none of it other than JBL's performance, which I think was pretty good, jumped off the page at me.
What do you think of the Alpha Academy losing to Anderson and Gallows as more than jobbers, but I mean, it was pretty clear they were there to just put over Anderson and Gallows. I know the OC and AJ is, you know, AJ is a big deal and they're feuding with the Judgment Day and you want to put them over, but I guess I just feel like Alpha Academy were really entertaining and somewhat credible. Certainly Otis, I know Gable took the fall here. I don't know. It just feels like this could be a feud as opposed to just sort of an enhancement match.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think a lot of that has to do with my relatively high opinion of Chad Gable and Otis and my relatively low opinion of what Carl Anderson and Luke Gallows have been doing for the last couple of years. And so I guess, you know, I would have preferred to have seen Gable and Otis be treated a little bit better, but I know just given the fact that we're getting the OC and and Judgment Day at Crown Jewel, that's probably not in the cards, at least for the short term. Maybe we'll actually see that develop into a feud once Crown Jewel wraps up and they got someplace else to go in November.
Where could Otis have gone, or where can he still go in the right? Because I mean, he was there for, you know, he's been there to be sort of upper mid card fodder at this point for like Braun, but I don't know. I feel like they were onto something with him, and Gable's so talented on the mic, and they're losing something by putting them. I guess part of it too is just, I just think Anderson and Gallows are sort of, you know, at this point. I'm glad later in the show, you know, they had them, you know, AJ goes, "You guys haven't changed," when they were willing to just take Cameron Grimes' money to go fight his fight. And I thought that was a good segment. I think it's important to establish who Anderson and Gallows are, and not just think, well, this is a return that will cater to people who were really into Bullet Club 5 years ago. And I like that, you know, although it's sort of a babyface, like I think Jason Paul pointed this out in his report at ProWrestling.net tonight, it almost seemed like Balor was the babyface, making fun of people still doing the Too Sweet thing and kind of living in, you know, 2016, 2017 or whatever.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of in agreement. It does feel a bit stale at this point. You know, I wasn't excited about the club sort of getting back together again, or the OC or whatever they're calling them now. And I think the crowd, you know, their relative lack of reaction for them when they walked out for their promo segment sort of joins in with that sentiment. It's just, it's not a very hot sort of property at this point. And I hope they figure that out before, you know, they start sacrificing more and more talent, you know, to them and putting them over. But we'll see which direction they go between now and Crown Jewel. But as far as the Gable and Otis and Alpha Academy, I think they probably need like one more member. So you know, maybe Gable can go back into singles competition, and Otis can work with somebody else as a tag team, because I think he really does excel in that environment. I'm trying to think who jumps out to me as somebody who could fit into that setup. And I guess it's there's really nobody just kind of hanging out doing nothing at this point. Maybe Dijakovic or T-Bar would be somebody that they could do something with, but I don't know if he necessarily fits into the theme of Alpha Academy.
Yeah. I thought the women's tag match tonight, just to bring that up, was a little clunky. It felt like Bianca Belair was especially having a little bit of an off night, but I don't know if that had to do with, you know, Kai and Sky not being – the timing wasn't right, but things just felt like they were a little sluggish and slow-mo a couple times in the match. Did that jump out to you?
Yeah, it wasn't anybody's best outing as far as I could tell. You know, and I think they need to give the women more tag team reps if they want them to have, you know, better matches on television on a regular basis. You know, they have those women's tag team titles, and, you know, Kai and Sky won them, but, you know, they've essentially been feuding with another thrown-together team over on SmackDown in, you know, Raquel and Shotzi, and there's really nobody else forming behind them to challenge them after that's over with. But I think as long as you're ending up having teams assembled, you know, of hastily thrown together singles wrestlers, you're going to have these outings where it's just like the timing is just not quite there, and I think that's what we saw tonight.
Yeah. Anything else from Raw that jumped out to you, Jake, worth chatting about?
I'm trying to think if there's anything that we didn't go over. I don't think so. I guess I keep, you know, every week when I sit down and I end up watching Raw, it's tough to pace a 3-hour show in a way that is able to maintain this, you know, a steady level of audience excitement. You know, it's a tough format, and I think they've done a better job as of late, you know, making sure that there's, you know, something worth sticking around for in all 3 hours. But I mean, I don't blame people who tune out or watch on DVR so they can, you know, they can skip things that they don't necessarily want to see. It's just a tough slog to get through. And I know Triple H feels the same way. You know, he's talked about his his willingness to get rid of the third hour, but financially it's just not really possible for them, or at least there's no, they don't desire it. So it's a tough show to sit down and sit through every week, especially if the show, if all the angles aren't clicking for you.
All right. Well, we'll wrap up on that note. I appreciate our callers and emailers. And remember, Dynamite tomorrow night. So not only are NXT and AEW going head-to-head, but two post-shows are going head-to-head. So we'll have our NXT post-show after NXT with, I believe, Kelly Wells will be hosting. And then we'll be back tomorrow night with our regular Dynamite post-show that normally occurs on Wednesday nights, Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Rich Fant co-hosting tomorrow night. So check things out there. I hope you can join us live. If not, certainly download the show afterwards. Jake, always a pleasure talking wrestling with you. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Thanks for having me, Wade. Take care.
You bet. Thanks, everybody.